to add one point to the discussion, if I may. It's referred to agrarian reform. I think we need to think beyond the land. We're not talking about land reform, we're talking about agrarian reform, which means land, resources, seeds, water, infrastructure, markets, and access to markets, transport. And I think one of the examples of big success in terms of agrarian reform and how that was, and also in agroecology alongside agrarian reform, is in Cuba. And we have here Roberto from Cuba. And I think it will be good to hear from him more about how agroecology works in Cuba. He's going to talk it later in the evening, but I think it's really good to hear from you to this discussion.
Nosotros promovemos un movimiento de agricultura sostenible sobre bases agroecológicas.
First, we promote a movement for sustainable agriculture.
Agroecología.
Following agroecological rules, basics.
O sea, no propiamente agricultura orgánica.
I'm going to
Yes.
Que nosotros lo que proponemos es una agricultura sostenible sobre bases agroecológicas, no agricultura orgánica.
So, what in Cuba are promoting is sustainable agriculture based on agroecology, but no organic agriculture.
¿Qué queremos decir con eso? Es un movimiento que nosotros tratamos de mantener, sobre todo sobre un principio ético.
So this is a movement that we try to keep or based on in an ethical principle.
Nosotros no queremos que el gobierno le ponga un precio más alto a nuestros productos.
So they don't want, or in Cuba, they don't want that the government put a higher price to their products.
Nosotros queremos que le pongan una multa al que no produce ambientalmente amigable.
They want that the government put a fine to those that they don't produce in a sustainable way.
Porque nosotros tenemos que pensar cuando producimos en lo que tienen que comprar nuestros productos.
Because when you are producing, you need to think who is going to consume or buy the product.
Y creemos que no es sostenible producir nada más para personas que más dinero tienen.
And they think that it's not sustainable to produce just for people who are able to buy the food.
Pero al mismo tiempo, no se puede hablar de agricultura sostenible si no es económicamente sostenible para el agricultor.
But we cannot talk, at the same time, we cannot talk about sustainable agriculture when it's not economically sustainable for the farmer, for the producer.
Yo le tengo mucho miedo a los subsidios y las ayudas gubernamentales.
And I have a lot of fear to subsidize and helps from the government.
Porque son cosas que varían tanto como varía la política.
Because there are things that change in the same way that the policies change.
Y yo no puedo poner mi economía en manos de políticos que por conveniencia pueden cambiar en cualquier momento lo que se está haciendo.
And I cannot put my... Sorry, Roberto, ¿puedes repetir?
Que no puedo poner mi economía en manos de políticos que varían la política por conveniencia, por coyunturas internacionales, etc.
And I cannot put my economy on the hands of the wings of changes of the politicians, of the international politicians. They cannot put their economy on their hands.
Yo creo que ahí entra el tema soberanía.
And I think that's where the theme of sovereignty comes.
O sea, yo tengo que tratar de que el agricultor sea lo más soberano posible.
So I have to try that the farmer is the more sovereignty possible.
Y bueno, el camino por el que nosotros hemos transitado es primero el rescate de la cultura agraria de cada lugar, el conocimiento local.
So the first thing that we are starting to do is recover the cultural tradition in each place.
Porque estos conceptos complejos que hemos inventado los académicos de producción agroecológica, de permacultura, de todos estos nombres complicados, no es más que lo que toda la vida hicieron los agricultores en el mundo.
Because all these theories about permaculture and all theories that the academics have come up with is just nothing else than what people have been doing traditionally for centuries.
Y son cosas que son muy diferentes de un lugar a otro.
And there are things that are quite different from one place to another.
Y no hay ningún científico que sea capaz de conocer esas diferencias.
And there is no scientific in the world that can know all these subtle differences.
Solamente las conocen los agricultores de cada uno de esos lugares.
Only is known by the farmers, by the peasants in those places.
Y entonces nosotros trabajamos mucho la promoción desde ese conocimiento local.
Then is where we work based on that knowledge, local knowledge. That's what we start with.
Y eso nos ayuda también a convencer a los campesinos, porque el campesino le tiene mucho amor a sus antepasados, y cuando tú le dices de lo que estamos hablando es de volver a hacer lo que decía, volver a empezar a hacer sobre la base de lo que hacía tu abuelo, enseguida está de acuerdo con hacerlo.
And that made a lot of sense for small farmers, peasants, because they love the tradition, they love what is behind it. And when they talk about that, when you talk about your elderly, and then what the knowledge that they have, they immediately understand what they're talking about and they get attached to that.
Ahora, como el mundo ha cambiado, no solo climáticamente, sino económicamente y políticamente.
As the world have changed, not just in a climatic point of view, but politically as well.
No podemos pensar que haciendo lo mismo que se hacía hace 100 años se puede lograr los mismos resultados hace 100 años.
We cannot think that what we used to do 100 years ago is going to give the same results now.
Entonces ahí está, me parece, la misión de los académicos y los que queremos promover esa agricultura, de incorporarle nuevos conocimientos que puedan enriquecer y perfeccionar este viejo modo de hacer agricultura, pero sobre la base del modo local de hacer agricultura.
Then this is the work of the people, like the academics, to try to work more on finding new methods that support that traditional way of producing, to support that rather than making something. Sorry, I'm waiting.
Así es como nosotros lo pensamos, y bueno, después por la noche le vamos a presentar algunos resultados de los claros que les digo. Nuestra forma de hacer nuestra agricultura sostenible no nació de una conciencia, nació de una crisis.
I'm going to give you more examples about the results of what we're doing in Cuba later on in the evening, in the talk in the evening. But what I want to say that what we have in Cuba at the moment is not the result of a conscientization of people. It was the result of a crisis.
O sea, yo le digo a la gente que nosotros empezamos a producir agroecológicamente porque o lo hacíamos o nos poníamos de acuerdo.
What he's saying is that in Cuba, they say if we have to produce agroecologically in an agroecological way, otherwise we are going to die.
Porque de un día para otro se perdieron todos los insumos externos que utilizaban para hacer agricultura.
Because overnight they lost all the external inputs that they have to produce to do agriculture.
Y ahí descubrimos cuán poco soberanos eran.
And there they discovered how small they were in terms of sovereignty.
Y por lo tanto no queremos volver a ser dependientes de nadie para hacer agricultura.
That's why they don't want to be dependent of anyone to create to do agriculture. So this is for Roberto from Cuba, and I'm happy to take more inputs, more comments from you.
A sort of small question really to everyone. You know, we've talked about some of the things. I know I'm thinking specifically just talking about the Food for Life partnership. One thing I didn't mention was that the funding is now running out for this phase in December. And I would like to ask anybody here if they know any way that we can get the government behind something that has been, it's been a world model. You know, we have countries from all over the world coming to study us and find out how we've done it. How do we keep it going? And some of the other positive inputs that people have talked about. Any ideas?
Diana, I think I welcome people from here in the UK that wants to add more to the discussion in terms of land access here, when there is a big, big thing in terms of accessing land here.
I have two kind of quite broad questions about the concepts. The first is about practicality of agroecology, and the second is about the politics of food sovereignty. The first question is, Sarath talked a lot about regenerating natural systems, and Roberto talked about the farmer's intimate knowledge of the natural environment. Presumably the difficulty here is if you have farmers nearby, neighbouring farms, or perhaps a few kilometres away, who aren't practising agroecology, who are using major chemical inputs, or even more so using genetically modified seed, and how does one cope with that? The second question, which is about food sovereignty, which I guess may come up in the next bit of the discussion, is, as I understand it, inherently, to some extent, food sovereignty is about a deindustrialisation of the food supply chain. And while I don't think any of us would lament reduced profits for Monsanto or Cargill or Tesco, doesn't it put us, as advocates of food sovereignty, in some degree of confrontation with trade unions? And has anyone thought about the politics of that and how we avoid being rivals of others who could be searching for farms? Okay, the first part is, you talked about by practicing agroecology, about restoring and regenerating natural systems. My question was, if you as a farmer are practicing that kind of approach, a few kilometres away, you have a major farmer who's using large-scale chemical inputs, which are getting into the water supply, or even more so who is using genetically modified seed and that's causing cross-contamination, doesn't that person, that other farmer, who is gaining from the additional productivity in the short term, undermine your longer-term efforts?
Firstly, I wouldn't say that the farmer who uses more external inputs gets greater productivity. This is a myth. He exploits the resources that are available in nature more extensively and more destructively. Therefore, he depletes his land. Therefore, he has to keep on adding more and more of external inputs that are becoming more and more expensive and destructive, because they are all fuel-based. And fuel costs are increasing, therefore, cost of fertilizer, for instance, in Sri Lanka is completely beyond the reach of ordinary small farmers. So the government gives a big subsidy, very unaffordable. By adopting a full package of ecological farming, when I say full package, all those factors that I mentioned in my earlier intervention has to be practiced together. Therefore, more sunlight gives you more plants and more leaves, that gives you more fertilizer and soil fertility, that gives you more microbial activity, that regenerates soil. Therefore, it gives very high productivity on the whole. The soil regenerates its productive abilities, while the plants themselves also produce at various levels, including ground, underneath the ground, yams and other crops, surface production like leafy vegetables, and then on fruits and so on in trees. So on the whole, it's very high productivity. In fact, we have done this, and there are very quite extensive places where this can be practically demonstrated. The overall productivity is much higher. I agree with you that there has to be a movement of transforming the whole approach. There is the advantage or the faith that we have that it will happen is because the present type of conventional farming, input dependent farming, expensive farming, very destructive farming is pushing out more and more people out of their land, out of their productivity, out of their livelihoods. Therefore, these people who are rejected in the present system, they are becoming larger and larger and larger, and they have become the largest numbers. They have to recover their ability to survive by restoring nature. So it's bound to be a trend, and there are definite advantages in the hands of small producers, external resource poor producers, who are pushed out of the present economy. These are world phenomena. And I don't know, I would be very happy if more people do more research on how these principles can be applied in the West here. I don't know enough to say about it, because there is a winter season when plants don't grow, so there is one season only. So whether it can be whether more plants can be grown during the other season, so that you restore your ability of regeneration, has to be worked on.
I'm conscious about the time I'm going to leave.
Let me just add a word about the other question.
Okay, Sarah is going to finish with the second question, and then we will try to close the session.
Yeah. About workers, industrial workers, it is true that trade unions have generally tended to fight for higher wages, and companies, big companies, make more profits, earn more profits, and pay them higher wages. There has to be a common understanding among trade union, among workers, among industrial workers, among farmers, among those who are pushed out. Workers are being pushed out also, who are excluded because they are not needed. All those people who are rejected because they are needed in the system will have to get together and create a new system where they are not rejected anymore. There has to be common understanding.
I know there are other hands there, probably coming up. We will have another discussion later on, so let's keep our thoughts together on this. But I just wanted to say that, let's remember that food sovereignty is not just talking about agroecology. We are talking about economics, politics, we talk about organizing communities, we talk about democratic control, and we are going to talk more about that in the next session. So let's keep the thoughts there, and I will answer the challenges that farmers had when they had to compete with the big industrialized, the large industrialized agriculture. We are going to have first John Hillary, Executive Director of War on One, who is going to talk us more about organizing the trade. John.
Graciela, thank you very much. And as Graciela said earlier, food sovereignty is not just about the agroecological practice of farming, or indeed just the issues around how we can regenerate the soil and all of the natural resources that we've been talking about. But it is a challenge to the predominant system of food production, consumption and distribution in the world. So for War on Want, certainly the food sovereignty movement is a political movement. It's a political movement to challenge exactly some of these issues we've already been talking about where the political money goes, where the political classes put their capital, and indeed why it is that all of the agroecological, organic, natural movements are marginalised by the world. And the food system is clearly a globalised system. And the way in which it's set up at the moment is a globalized system which revolves around increasing trade in agricultural products. And as Louise said right at the beginning, food is reduced to a commodity, like any other commodity in the system, like a computer, a car, anything else. Food becomes a commodity. And it's a commodity whose production, distribution is controlled by the major corporations who have profited so much from this system. And if you just think, with the FAO releasing its new hunger figures recently, with nearly a billion people now facing hunger in the world, you've still got the food companies making record profits. So while it's a crisis for the majority of the world, it's a bonanza for those who enjoy that position of power within the system. So food sovereignty is very much about challenging the system and challenging the idea that food should be seen as a global issue, and that we should be living in this global village whereby everybody partakes of food irrespective of where it comes from in the world. And certainly for those of us who've worked on trade policy for the last 20-odd years, this idea of a global village whereby you'll get your clothes from Bangladesh, you'll get your computers from China, you'll get your food from Brazil or the Midwest of the USA, that has become something very new. It's become something which is now seen as much more of a given, and it is a huge problem, because in reality, this brave new world of a global village has caused incredible damage to most of the farming communities who were, up until the 1980s, subsistent and also self-sufficient in food. And I just want to break this down very quickly in terms of looking at the trading system in terms of both the exports and the imports of food. Starting with the exports, if you think in the 1980s and the 1990s, when the World Bank and the IMF were imposing their structural adjustment programs on countries around the world, one of the key elements of this was that those countries should earn as much foreign exchange as they possibly could through exports. And for many countries of the global south in particular, the key element that they were meant to be exporting was food. And so you had this massive shift, this massive change away from subsistence self-sufficiency towards big corporate plantations, often monocropped, often monocultures, which were targeted towards the export market, the outward turn, as it's called, of the 80s and 90s. And you get situations where whole communities would be dispossessed of their lands. You think of, for example, the communities in Uganda, in huge quantities thrown off their land to make way for a German coffee plantation. There are many, many other examples you will know from around the world, which you can fill in at your own leisure. And you get the success stories as they are portrayed to us. For example, Kenya's horticulture industry, which now employs 60, 70, 80,000 people, all producing crops, producing cash crops for export and sale in European markets. But what's become absolutely clear, it was clear even from the beginning in the 80s and 90s, I remember a delegation of Zimbabwean farmers coming over to the UK at the beginning of the 1990s, saying this is already incredibly problematic for us, because we're seeing all of the land that we were basically living off being sequestered, put away for big business to be able to use for export-oriented agriculture. And it leaves the farmers, the people who are employed in those farms, at the vagaries of the international markets. It also destroys the power of those individuals to be able to determine what they grow, how they grow, and how they feed themselves. They're now at the mercy of the big retailers, the big agricultural food buyers, which dominate the market. And also it leads to the commodification of labor. It's not just food being seen as a commodity, but it's their labor and their control over their own lives which is commodified. And that is at the heart of the loss of any power in the system, where you have been turned from a farmer in control of your own land, in control of your own sustenance, to a wage slave. And I use that term advisedly, because a lot of the work that War on Want has done has been tracing back through the supply chains to see the exploitation of workers at that bottom level in plantations across the world, serving British supermarkets and getting an absolute pittance, while the big supermarkets here make huge profits. Think of Tesco, £3 billion in profit last year, and still unable to share the benefits down the supply chain. Another particular problem about the whole export orientation is that workers face a very precarious situation, because capital is highly mobile. When capital is finished in a particular country like Kenya, where the water is all drying up and all of the conditions for farming are considered no longer to be as optimum as they were, capital can move next door, in this case to Ethiopia, and all of the people who now have got their jobs within those plantations are thrown back onto absolutely no alternatives, because all the natural resources have been used up and therefore they have no jobs to go to. That's the export side. The import side is, if anything, even more damaging. And the theory of this, the theory of international trade in food, is that it's more efficient. If everybody opens up their markets, you basically get a greater efficiency in terms of the overall global system, which means food is cheaper, everybody gets a better deal, and everything's fine for the future. The opposite is true. It's an absolute disaster through competition on the international basis, which has wiped out rural communities in country after country. And you think of countries like Mexico, where 2 million campesinos lost their jobs in traditional agriculture as a result of the trade liberalizations of the 1980s and 90s. Haiti, which has been created as a failed state as a result of those policies. Many, many other countries. Philippines, which was self-sufficient in food and is now reliant upon imports as a result of those changes. And it's really important here to recognize this is not just as a result of subsidized dumping. Many of you will have heard that the great evil in the global system is that if you have European and US farmers, particularly the big farmers who are subsidized up to the gills, and they can then dump their produce at the low cost of production on developing countries, that wipes out whole communities. That is true, but it's not only that. It's not that if you get rid of the subsidies, the free market will work perfectly. It's absolutely not that. Take a case like Ghana, for example. Ghana, 20 years ago, 90% of all the rice eaten in Ghana was grown in Ghana. Now, 90% of all the rice eaten in Ghana is imported. And the entire rice economy and all of the other parts around it has been destroyed. And that's not because it's subsidized food being dumped there, it's because of competition from more industrialized farming in Brazil, Thailand, and Vietnam. Now, I'm coming to the end of my This is quite a new thing, as I said. That basically, the agriculture, the agreement on agriculture at the WTO was only brought into force in 1994, so it's less than 20 years old. It was written by the vice president of Cargill. I don't know if this is widely known to people. The agreement on agriculture, which was agreed and signed up to by the WTO members, was written by the vice president of Cargill, so it's hardly a surprise that it actually works in their interests. But there has been really important resistance in those world trade talks. And the reason that the Doha round of world trade talks is, I'm very happy to say, stalled and in the deep freeze, is precisely because of resistance from farmers' movements around the world, which have made it impossible for countries like India in particular, but also other southern countries, to sign up to that deal. We can maybe talk about that a little bit later. I just want to conclude by saying this. Food sovereignty is not anti-trade. Food sovereignty puts trade back in its proper place. Food sovereignty puts the needs of people before the needs of capital. Puts people's needs before profit. It also puts the localization of food first. So you have your own subsistence, you'll produce for local markets, and if there are then any surpluses, they can then be traded on open markets. And for us, I think that whole reconstruction, that reorientation of the trade model is what brings us to the very real politics of the food sovereignty movement. It's not just agroecology, it's not just about nice farming, it's about challenging a system which has dispossessed most of the people on the planet. And I think that's why it needs our combined support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.